This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zandin for Jane Lindholm. If you're a parent, no doubt your child has fought with others or talked back or refused to clean up a mess. Vicki Hopeful asked the parents in one of her classes to raise their hands if they disciplined a child at least 20 times to deal with those behaviors. Every hand went up. And then she asked them to keep their hands up if they thought using the same approach another 20 times would solve the problem. Most people didn't think it would. The exercise illustrates what Hopeful calls the failure of a disciplinary approach to parenting problems as opposed to one that emphasizes training and takes the long view, letting things slide in many cases and enabling children to learn to take responsibility. Today, we talk with parent educator Vicki Hopeful about her book, Duct Tape Parenting, a response to the overly protective, busy, micromanaging approach to child rearing that we've come to call helicopter parenting. So, what kind of parent are you? Duct tape or helicopter or another kind? Do you feel you're more of a maid or an assistant to your child, cleaning up for them, making sure they're well organized, and generally clearing a path through life for them? Give us a call or shoot us an email with your responses and let us know how your approach to parenting is working or not working at 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. Vicki Hopeful, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Well, parenting can take many forms, as we were just describing, and sometimes it seems like we see trends in parenting. I think of the spare the rod, spoil the child approach of earlier times, approach with very tightly prescribed boundaries, and then there are approaches with very few boundaries, and then we've got the helicopter parenting we just described. Do you think there's a prevalent approach to parenting these days?
I think helicopter parenting is still kind of the newest, latest trend, but it's starting to decline as parents recognize that their attempts at being overly controlling and managing kids' lives isn't getting them the kinds of results that they were hoping for. And I think there's a new conversation that started about, well, if not that, then what? And therein lies the conversation about whether duct tape parenting has any relevance to parents as they begin to answer that question.
So describe what you mean by duct tape parenting.
So I really think that for most of us as parents, we want two things. We want to enjoy our children when they're in our homes and their children and revel in all the magic that that means and offer them guidance and be involved in their lives and share all those memories. But there's a part of us that also realizes that there's a bigger responsibility, and that responsibility is to ensure that our kids are ready to leave our homes at 18 and join society with the kinds of skills and experience that will ensure that they can create meaningful and satisfying lives and be contributing members of their communities. And I think it's reconciling both of those things is really at the cornerstone of duct tape parenting.
And I could see every parent, no matter what their approach is, kind of nodding in agreement to what you just said. Just practically speaking, you have five kids in your family, ages 20 to 25, from what I understand. So tell a story, if you would, from your own parenting that explains what that philosophy looks, the duct tape parenting approach looks like in action.
So when the kids were young, let's say they were going to daycare and they were at an age where it's kind of the I do, which typically starts at about three. But it's also when they're slow and awkward and they can't stay focused. And so it's a parent's propensity to say, oh, sure, you can help me, but you're going to do the things I want you to do, and I'm going to take over the bulk of getting you ready. And this is the first place that we can start to take a step back and say, okay, I have a child who wants to be engaged in the world. So I'm going to set up small things that they're going to be in charge of. And if they do them slowly, it's fine. It isn't going to completely disrupt the flow of the morning. So that those skills begin to grow and they master those small skills, like remembering to pick up their backpack or pick out the shoes they're going to wear for the day, or help pick out the snacks they're going to eat, to entering kindergarten and first grade where there are more responsibilities. Now they have friends, they have homework, maybe they play sports. And so we're growing with our children. We're allowing them opportunities to forget their lunch and go to school hungry for a day or two so that they are building that mental muscle that says, wait a minute, I need a list to remind me of all the things I have to do, or some other way, some other mechanism for them to navigate their world. And if we start when they're young, imagine what it will be like for them when they're in the 8th, 9th, and 10th grade, and they've got to manage even more things on their plate.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, you talk about things like, letting the child take responsibility for waking up in time for school, rather than going in five times, you know, and reminding the child it's time to get up and get out and get ready for school. And I think, you know, while we can understand how that might be beneficial, we're also scratch our heads and go, yeah, but the reality is I got to go to work. We've got to get out the door at a certain time. And so I have to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. But I don't want to be fighting with a 13-year-old. I just can't imagine that my life as a parent is about going into my 13-year-old's room and saying, get up. The alarm clock has been going off 15 minutes. We are going to – like, I don't want to have that conversation after the second grade. I want that to be a skill that my child has mastered so that they can pick up a rhythm for their own life. Listen, I have one kid who could get up 15 minutes before the bus arrived. He would slide down the banisters, throw a granola bar in his mouth, grab his backpack, throw him whatever shoe was available, and hit the bus with a smile on his face. But I also had one that got up 2.5 hours early, had to read the entire paper, have a cup of tea. So in giving, in teaching them about getting up with an alarm clock, I was doing more than just saying, here, you know, you're responsible for this. And it is inconvenient. That's true. But so is a child who's vomiting in the morning. But I don't see any parents going, hurry up, we got to get out of the house. Mm-hmm. In those moments, when it's physical health, we stop what we're doing and we attend to our children. Well, in my mind, this is their emotional health. This is what ensures that they become capable, resilient people. And it starts with an alarm clock.
So to follow up on the alarm clock example, Vicky, the idea is that if I let my child just take responsibility for, you know, getting up and out in the morning, and if that involves them oversleeping, missing the bus or whatever for a while, they're going to understand the consequences and they're, you know, they're going to put two and two together and take responsibility for getting up at the right time.
That's been my experience with not only my own children, but the parents that I work with. Now, there's training that goes along, and there are limitations and boundaries, and there are conversations. But at the end of the day, it's the experience of being late, of having to go to the office and explain why you're late, and mom isn't doing the talking, you are, or recognizing that you forgot your snack, so you're going to have to borrow somebody else's, that really anchors that learning for a child so that the next day they think to themselves, I'm not going to go through that again. I need to take responsibility for getting up on time and then making sure I have all my gear. That is never going to happen if a parent is there ensuring that the kids are up on time and breakfast is served and the backpacks are ready and the snacks have all, you know, got the food group. So it's really about, you know, passing over responsibility in small doses to the kids as they grow and mature.
We mentioned at the beginning of the program, you know, a couple of examples of misbehavior, fighting with other kids or talking back or not taking responsibility for something, things that, you know, parents often react to in the moment, sometimes angrily. And I think, you know, as you explain in your book, misbehaving is an attention-getting device, and I think most people wouldn't be surprised to learn that, but they might be surprised to learn that their attempts to deal with it really are just reinforcing it, in your view.
Yes. I call those pesky behaviors weeds. And so one of the activities I ask parents to do with me is just make a list of all the pesky behaviors their kids demonstrate, from, you know, whining and fighting and spitting and saying no and getting up from the table and they won't go to bed and they forget their – I mean, you know, the list is endless. And then I say, okay, so how do you deal with all of those pesky behaviors. And the list usually sounds something like, well, I nag them and I remind them and I lecture and I count and I 1, 2, 3 and I bribe and I punish. And I say, okay, imagine these pesky behaviors are the weeds and everything you just listed is the fertilizer. And all you're doing is ensuring that that weed is going to, you know, grow hardy. And I think it's a real aha moment for parents because they know intuitively it isn't working, but nobody really offers them a chance to just stop the craziness altogether. And that let's rethink what the child is really trying to tell us and then come up with some strategies that address what's really going on for the child, which is, I want your attention, or I want to have more say in what I eat for breakfast or what clothes I wear, or, you know, I feel like you don't listen to me enough and you like my other brother better. And so you can really flush out what's at the bottom of that behavior. And for me as a mom, I just couldn't imagine spending so many hours trying to deal with all that pesky behavior when I thought, wait a minute, if there's a real problem at the core of that, give me that. I want to know that. Mm-hmm. And I want to put my energy towards solving that real problem.
We're talking with Vicki Hoeffel, whose book is Duct Tape Parenting, a response. I don't know, Vicki, would this book have been written had helicopter parenting not come along?
Well, I've been teaching it for 25 years, so even back then there was a calling for it.
Well, Vicki's approach is one that emphasizes training over what we would consider discipline and contains a lot of examples, often drawn from the lives of parents that she's worked with. If you have questions based on what you've heard so far, questions or observations about your own parenting techniques, then call us at 1-800-639-2211 or you can email vermontedition@vpr.net. Vicki, as we mentioned, you make a clear distinction between discipline, what you, I think, call a Band-Aid approach, and training, which you say helps a child learn to be responsible and independent. Elaborate on that distinction a little for us.
So if you have a child who, you know, is struggling to organize their morning, and our propensity, you know, a noodler is the best example. You know, this is the kid who just can't keep themselves moving for more than 15 seconds without a little bit of prodding. And that becomes kind of your morning routine. You prod, come on, we got to go. Please get your stuff. Oh, but I want to play. It's just the parent's idea of a nightmare. And so there's this moment where we stop and we assess as parents, okay, what am I still doing for this child that the child could be doing for himself? And have I really taught him how to do that task and then given him the time to practice just one task until he becomes proficient? And with that new level of confidence and the mastery of that task, I can go get the next task. And over the course of several weeks, if you've got even a rudimentary plan in your own mind as the parent, you can watch a child go from needing direction for the entire hour from the time he wakes up till the time he gets into the car to a much quieter morning when the child is directing their own steps, taking care of the tasks because they've mastered them. And you're only intervening when you see them kind of bump up against, wait a minute, what happens next? So imagine that in 4 months, you have a child now who's getting up with the alarm clock and getting dressed and doing all of those things, and you're visiting with your child. There's real engagement now. You're talking about the upcoming day instead of where are the socks, where are your shoes, go get your backpack, please sit down, you've got to eat, you don't want to be hypoglycemic. So it gives parents a chance to really engage with their kids in a way that I think we want, which goes beyond just the daily tasks of getting out of the door.
Okay, good. Let's take a call from Maria in South Burlington. Hi, Maria. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
I just was commenting on your program and your book, and, you know, I think you're doing a great job, you know, just really teaching parents how to, they can remember things to do or remember their tasks. But I was just commenting that I am a grandmother now. I raised 4 children. I lived in Germany for many years. And my belief is that raising, teaching a child how to do those daily tasks is being a mothers or need to be good role models. I think that's really important for a child, and to give your children as much love as you can, teaching them and you know, guiding them through. For example, you know, they're getting dressed in the morning, you're going to school in the morning, but how do I know what to wear? How do I know that? I remember putting, you know, just teaching the children, look at the weather, this is what would be appropriate for that day, right. Leaving it on a little chair, you know, their shoes and their socks, and just kind of guiding and teaching them how to organize themselves so that next morning, I used to wake them up with a little kiss and say, you know, time to get up, and they got dressed, and they loved it, and I think throughout life, and I never timed it 4 months or 5 or 6 months, it was just a daily task as a, you know, brushing your teeth and getting dressed, and at some point, they really liked that. They wanted to do that independently. So this is just a comment, and of course, this is only one task, and there are many, many tasks in the life of a child and a parent, and I do not have to work, as many other parents have to work nowadays, so I'm just commenting, and...
All right. Thank you, Maria. So, you know, what Maria is describing, and I think it's similar to what you're describing, Vicki, it's a matter of consultation more than issuing directions.
Absolutely. At the core of it, we want our kids to develop a sense of independence. We know that they're driven to become independent. And what we want to do is create an environment in our homes where that's a pleasant experience for everyone, where the parents have decided intentionally that they're going to take some time to train their kids, give them time to practice, allow for mistakes so that there's not a lot of stress, and the kids feel supported and curious and excited about taking on new tasks. And it also gives them a chance to experience frustration and this is difficult for me, and to feel the support of a parent without the parent coming to their rescue. Mm-hmm. So on so many levels, you're teaching resiliency, cooperation, you know, stick-to-itiveness, creative ways of solving problems, which are all things we want our kids to embody and to develop over time.
We're talking today with parent educator Vicki Hoeffel, who for years has taught classes on parenting. She writes about her experience in the book Duct Tape Parenting, A Less is More Approach to Raising Respectful, Responsible, and Resilient Kids. What do you think of what you've heard so far? Does this fit with your experience as a parent or as a child? And what have you found works and doesn't work? Let us know at 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zand in for Jane Lindholm. Our guest today says raising children is a matter of training them, not disciplining them. The difference lies in abandoning what she calls a Band-Aid approach to putting out fires and instead adopting a give-and-take attitude toward our children, one that builds responsibility and sound decision-making. In her book, Duct Tape Parenting, Vicki Hoeffel says, don't sweat the details, let children make mistakes, and they'll learn from them. I'd like to hear what you think at 1-800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vpr.net. Vicki, Andrew posted this online. He writes, I definitely overparent, but one place I've been able to restrain myself is when my small children are climbing on rocks and logs. I don't say, are they going to get hurt? I say, how much are they going to get hurt? And if it's not much, I back off. Taking off from that, Vicki, I think some people might feel, yeah, but, you know, there are times when we really do need to take control in order to protect our children.
Yes. If they're going to engage in something that's morally or physically dangerous, by all means, jump in and jump in immediately. But there are so many opportunities for children to explore their lives and to learn how to navigate the terrain with very few bumps and bruises and, really not much worry from parents. But we miss those opportunities because we've got in our heads at some point, I don't know exactly when this happened, but we started believing that good parenting meant that our kids – you know, walked through life unscathed with smiles on their faces and always had everything they needed and were prepared for every event. And I think we do a real disservice to kids when, you know, when we kind of take over the navigating of their lives instead of letting them do that. And the truth is, they're not going to do a very good job of it for many years. But I think that's the point of childhood.
I think, you know, parents often instinctively, and it's not out of a desire to control, it's out of a desire to help, want to do things for their children, want to make their children's lives easier. You have a story, I don't think it's in the book, Vicki, about your daughter having an automobile accident.
Yes, I do.
I wonder if you could tell that one.
Sure. So my oldest daughter was, you know, had gotten her driver's license and, you know, was a great driver from, you know, from our perspective. And I got a call one night just about dusk, and she said, "Mom, I've been in an accident." This was in Shoreham, and she was crossing a bridge, and it was slippery and icy, and the car kind of went off of the bridge halfway. And she called, said, I've been in an accident in the car, and she was crying. And I said, "Okay, take a deep breath. Are you okay? Look at your body and tell me, is there any blood or a break?" And she said, no, I'm okay." And I said, "Great, call me when you figure out what to do next." And I hung up the phone. And now, I know it sounds harsh, so I'll just say right now that my heart was beating and I was sweating and I was sick to my stomach. And I thought, oh, my God. And I waited for the phone to ring, and she called about 2 minutes later, and she goes, "I called AAA. I think that's what I'm supposed to do, right? I'm a AAA." I said, "Right." And she said, "But now what?" And I said, "I don't know. Call me in as soon as you figure out what happens next." And I hung up the phone. And this happened like 3 or 4 times. And every time I hung up the phone, I really questioned like what I was doing and if this was the right thing. And the last phone call I got was from her saying, "Hi. The tow truck is here. I have my cell phone on, so if he's sketchy or he tries anything funny when I get in the cab, I have my car and I'm ready to jump out. We're going to tow it to the Sunoco, and the Sunoco guys are ready to take a look at it. If somebody could come and pick me up, that would be really cool." And I thought, oh, this is interesting. In less than a half an hour, I have a 16-year-old who is crying, scared to death. And within 30 minutes, I have this confident, slightly cocky child who thinks, I did this.
The interesting thing, I think, Vicki, is I think your daughter told you later she was pretty upset with you when
yes.
you were – yeah.
Yeah, she was. We talked about it, and a friend of mine said, "I can't believe you did that." And I said, you know, my only thought, the thing that got me through this was thinking, if this had happened and I was living in Iowa, I couldn't have gotten in my car and driven to her and saved her. She would have had to have figured out how to do it. And this was a chance for her to find out – that she had what it took and that she would be okay, but I was close enough to get to her if I needed to. And she did share that she was not particularly happy with me when I hung up the phone the first time, but that, you know, by the fifth time she was feeling like, geez, my mother must think I'm a rock star. She keeps hanging up the phone on me like I know what I'm going to do. She said, but it forced me to think like, wait a minute, we've talked about this. And that was my point to her is, Hannah, you've had 16 years in this family. You know how to solve problems. But when something like that happens, your brain freezes up and your job is to release it and to keep reminding yourself right. that you've got what it takes to get through this.
Let's bring Peggy in Williston into the conversation. Hi, Peggy.
Hi there. I've been kind of listening with some degree of interest to this discussion, and I wanted to add a point or two. There are many of us in town that own our own businesses. I own a veterinary clinic. I hate to see kids come in the door. I really have gotten to the point where I almost want to keep them out of my practice. They're so undisciplined. They come in with their parents. They run all over. They stick their fingers in cages. Their parents don't do anything to stop them. And I think, if anything, we need a little more discipline with our children rather than less of it. I grew up back in my generation, parents were a little stricter. And we were focused very early on things that we could do and what we could not do. So I'm not so sure that I agree with what this woman is saying, just based on what I've seen in my business practice and also what I have done with my own life. As a very disciplined child, I was disciplined all of my life. I have 3 advanced degrees. I'm a lawyer. I'm a veterinarian. I have a master's degree in pathology. I've been extremely successful. And I may not have been that successful if I would not have had some fairly strict guidelines from my parents.
All right. Peggy, it's kind of a noisy line, but thank you for making the point. And Peggy's point is basically, Hey, I'm walking proof that discipline works, and really isn't discipline a form of training?
So she makes a great point. And here's where part of the rub is. This is not about permissive parenting. I assure you, I was not going to turn my house over to five little hooligans that were going to do whatever they wanted to, and I was going to be at their every whim. The goal for me was to teach my children self-control, self-discipline, and self-regulation. That's my goal, because I could control my kids in my home. I could give them the hairy eyeball and get them all to snap to. I'm a Reformed Catholic. I don't even need, you know, timeouts or 1-2-3s. But what I worried about was how would they behave in that woman's office when I wasn't there? And I wanted them to conduct themselves in a respectful way because they'd been practicing in their own home. So when I talk about, you know, discipline strategies, which many parents would describe as nagging, lecturing, counting, 1-2-3, punishments don't work. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that there's no room for discipline, but it's in transferring that to the kids and saying, listen, this is how society works, and this is how you develop the self-discipline.
Right. Would you say maybe the kids Peggy was observing have neither the discipline approach nor the approach you're discussing in their lives?
Absolutely. I think their parents don't know what to do. And when they get out in public, you know, the tools that they use at home, you can't use in public. And the kids know it, so they take advantage of that. And yeah.
All right. Let's talk next with Tricia in Montpelier. Tricia, thanks for joining us.
Hi there. I'm really impressed with what I'm hearing. I think though what really hit me is the fear of judgment by other parents. You know, if my kid doesn't have their lunch, oh my goodness, what are they going to think if she's dirty, if she forgot to brush her hair? But those are all consequences.
Yeah, this is a. You really bring up a great point, Tricia, and it's one, Vicki, you touch on over and over again, I think, in your book, that we're motivated sometimes by the way we're going to appear.
Absolutely. The pressure is unbearable for parents out there right now. I mean, everybody is keeping track of everybody else as a way to figure out how well they're doing in this game called parenting. And, you know, I was in that boat. My kids would go to school and I would get the hairy eyeball from everybody. And I finally came up with this one line that kind of made everybody pause. So when they'd say, oh, I noticed Zoe didn't bring her lunch again today, I'd say, no, I'm raising a thinking child. And sometimes thinking children are messy. And when you say the words thinking child, people are hard-pressed to say, no, you don't want to do that. You want her to have the lunch. And so it gave me kind of this armor that I needed to go out there and practice what I was preaching and what I believed was in the best interest of my kids. But I remember feeling beat up when I would get home and thinking everybody is looking at me like, what are you doing, lady? Your kid came to soccer practice and she didn't have her soccer shoes. Like, really? But you know what? 2 years later, it was my kid who was supplying everybody else's kids with soccer shoes. So
here's a question from Leah, Vicki. She writes, please suggest an appropriate response to a child you've asked to do something but who refuses, such as cleaning something up. I've used with some success your advice in the book to ask what needs to happen for this to work, but that's often met with complete silence and disengagement.
So there are two things. First of all, anytime a child is not cooperating with their parents, there's something off with the relationship. And that doesn't mean that the relationship is terrible, but I always try and sniff out where the power struggle is in the relationship, because you can usually find it at the center. The child is trying to say, you know what? I don't want to cooperate with you. And for me personally, it was like, gee, I don't like to cooperate with people I don't like. So maybe my child doesn't like me very much right now. So there's that. And the second thing that I used that was pretty successful was to say to the child, okay, I'm not going to get into a fight with you about this. I can't make you do it without both of us feeling bad. So I'm going to wait until you need me to do something for you. And then my answer will be yes. As soon as you do what I asked you to do 15 minutes ago, I would be happy to drive you to Ben Franklin's to get the glue for the science project.
Here's a post from John, Vicki, who asks you to talk about the place for screens, TV, computer, Kindle, phone in raising a child. John says, if the answer is the trash, how do I convey that to my spouse?
No, it's not the trash. Technology is here to stay. It's part of our lives and it's part of our kids' lives. And, you know, if we start young talking to kids about the responsibilities that go along with the privilege of technology, we have a better chance of setting reasonable limits and boundaries, allowing our children to be part of the conversation and to help set family policy with the idea that if they take advantage of those family policies or agreements, that there's the chance that they could lose the privilege. So it's always more than just what's the strategy. It really means pulling the family together and talking about what's the value, what are we afraid of, what are we worried about, how are we going to keep everybody safe, and parents need to get educated on technology. They have to start to feel comfortable because it's going to be a part of their children's lives, and we do not want to not be part of that conversation.
You know, Vicki, John alludes to this in the note I just read, but raising a child usually involves two parents, and those two parents may have different approaches to child rearing. How do you deal with that, let's say, in the environment of the classes you teach?
So I offer a tool that's called the roadmap. And this oftentimes helps parents get on the same page around a particular sticky subject. So let's say it's technology. And they both have this idea about, you know, how much of it should be available to their kids. But what we're really talking about is a value that each one of them have. So identifying that value, one of them could be they should be outside playing, and the other one's value could be, you know, they need to take advantage of technology because it will help them in their job. And you kind of flush out that conversation and then figure out, where do you intersect? Where is it that you can come together as parents and you start the conversation there? So it means that both parents move a little bit. Nobody's going to change their mind completely. And then you ask the kids to come in and start to say, okay, now there's this third party. Tell us what technology means to you, or tell us what curfew means to you, or tell us what whatever that issue is. And I have found that they can very quickly identify the central value and build consensus from there.
I think there are probably a lot of parents listening to some of the things you're saying, Vicki, and saying, yeah, but.
Yeah, but.
And Meg may have a yeah, but. She asks, how do you deal with a child who is sneaky, using the computer outside of mutually agreed on times, for example, taking money from mom, even though she earns her own, and then lying about it?
Yeah, that's tough. And for me, it goes back to what's missing in this scenario. And when it's about stealing and lying and, you know, sneaking and breaking agreements, there's usually a lack of courage the child feels in their life. Like, they don't believe they have what it takes to take responsibility for the decisions they're making. And so they sneak, or they lie, or they cheat, or they steal. And so it's important that a parent look around the child's life and do an assessment strategy before you jump in there with some consequence or we're going to take this away. It's like, don't make it worse. Stop and assess. Look at your child and look at the relationship you have with them. Ask yourself, where else does this behavior show up in the child's life? Do they have the courage to make decisions, to take responsibility for those decisions? And a parent will very quickly figure out that there are areas that they can, and I consider this a skill set. So that's an area where the child needs practice and training. Mm-hmm. And then you can start to see a shift in the behavior.
Now, Vicki, a couple of we've heard from several listeners who have taken your classes and are appreciative of what you've taught them. A note came from Wendy who says, I took Vicki's class 7 years ago. I'm a single mom at this point and have super competent children who are 14 and 10. They manage their money, contribute around the house, do their laundry, and understand helping out. When they do fight and bug each other, they know they can choose to deal with the situation. Thanks, Vicki, she writes.
Thank you.
I think part of the message here, you know, is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that parenting skills don't come naturally as we might think, and that we need basically what you call cracking open our thinking about it.
Yep. I know it does for some people, but for me, it was a complete mystery. So I really needed to flush it out and decide for myself what I wanted for my kids and for myself.
There's an idea you talk about, or you talk in your book about the importance of family meetings.
Yes.
Vicki, elaborate on that a bit, if you would.
Family meetings are a 15-minute weekly strategy that I think probably kept my blended family together through all of the ups and downs of familyhood. They teach the kids how to be kind to each other and to their parents. It's an equitable distribution of the work. It teaches kids how to solve problems so there's no tattling. And it alleviates any arguments about money and will you buy this and will you replace that. And it became a cornerstone for the health of my family. And even though my kids are all living on the West Coast, we still have monthly family meetings because the kids love it so much. And it's a way for us to all connect.
Great. Vicki Hoeffel, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Vicki Hoeffel's book is Duct Tape Parenting. In a moment, we'll talk with the head of VSAC about what a recent survey of Vermont's graduating seniors illuminates in the gap between the desire for a college education and the reality of getting one. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back. I'm Steve Zinn for Jane Lindholm. This is a time in the school year when high school seniors who are going on to college are getting some clarity on exactly where they're going, what it's going to cost, and they can start to imagine where the next chapter of their lives might take them. But exactly which Vermont students are in that position of moving on to college is an uneven picture in Vermont. As VPR reported last week, a new study shows that it makes them noticeably less likely, females to pursue a college education. There are also some geographical gaps in which high school seniors continue their education. All this contained in a report released by VSAC, the Vermont Student Assistance Corporation, which helps students arrange financial aid and plan for college. Scott Giles is VSAC's president and CEO and joins me now to explain the findings. Scott, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me.
You know, one term used in the report is aspiration rate. Perhaps we could start by having you define that.
Sure. One of the things that VSAC has done for over 30 years is survey high school students and ask them questions about their plans for the future. Aspiration rate really reflects the extent to which these students have indicated that at some point after high school, they believe that they not only would like to, but will pursue some form of post-secondary education or training. And obviously, aspiring is the first step towards actually continuing.
And as we alluded to a moment ago, there is a difference between the aspiration rates of female and male students.
Absolutely. And I think we've seen this in education circles across the state for many years. And in fact, doing some research, it's a phenomenon that exists in the UK and most of the English-speaking world. For reasons that we're not all clear about, we've done a great job of really supporting what we refer to as first-generation women. Their aspiration and continuation rates and, in fact, their success in school has continued to grow for 20 years. We've not had that same success with boys.
Do we have any speculation about the causes for that?
I think that there are probably a couple of things. One of them reflects the changing nature of the economy. For a long time, it was possible for someone to achieve a real livable wage with only a high school diploma. And many of those jobs, thinking about the skilled trades, plumbing, electrical construction, and factory jobs, were available to young men. Years ago, as those jobs started to disappear, we seem to see girls begin to aspire towards positions that required more education, things like nursing, and then eventually, of course, other healthcare fields, becoming a doctor. Boys don't appear to have made that transition, even though we know now that you really can't obtain a job that will earn you a middle-class income with just that diploma.
Yeah, I don't think people would be surprised by another aspect of the report, which shows students whose parents went to college are more likely to go themselves. Those whose parents didn't go to college have lower aspiration rates. Is there any change in that when we look back on a series of reports? Is that something that should concern us and we should try to address?
You know, when we are working with students and families, when I ask a parent who had some college when they first made the decision that they were going to go on, they'll reply to us that in some to some extent they always knew, and it's because it was kind of baked into the family conversations that were taking place. That's not true for these students whose parents didn't have a degree. One of the things that concerns us about this is that we know it's possible through interventions in school to really begin to bend that curve, to create opportunities for these first-generation students to begin to aspire. And we haven't done as effective a job as we need to uniformly across the state.
Geography is another dimension that the report illuminates. And this might surprise people that there are actually geographic differences when we look at which seniors aspire to go on to college.
And I will say that having looked at this data as an organization for over 30 years, we found some surprises here as well. We'll just pick out one county. We've always known that there was a gap between these first and second generation students, but we believed that it was tied in part to the rural nature of the county or the economic circumstances of that county. This report shows us that that's not the case. So, for example, there's over a 30% gap in aspirations in Lamoille County. But in Essex County, similarly very rural, very similar economic challenges, that gap is only about 6%. We think it's critically important to understand what's going on in those particular counties so that we can develop interventions to try and really narrow that gap so all students have the same opportunities.
And in recognizing that, at this point, we can't say what is going on in those particular counties. Can we say there are more first-generation seniors, in other words, seniors whose parents didn't go to college in those areas?
No, at this point, the data doesn't indicate that there's anything substantially different in that regard. What we do see, however, are some differences with regard to the high school course selections that are being made, particularly early in school. This is one of the challenges that we find when we're counseling students. If a student doesn't decide to go on to post-secondary education or training until their sophomore or junior year, oftentimes they will have made course selections which make it hard, if not impossible, for them to pursue post-secondary education or training. Maybe they didn't take that math course. One of the things that we believe that we're beginning to see is some differences in course selection that may be having a pretty profound impact.
You know, we've been talking just in the context of Vermont, but when we sort of take the larger view and compare Vermont to the rest of the nation, I remember going to a conference, I guess it was last winter, where the big subject was, gee, Vermont has really high high school graduation rates above the national average, but where we're below the national average is the number of the percentage of high school graduates going to college. That's an issue it sounds like educators are grappling with these days.
You know, I think that that's exactly right. In the old days, you know, the old agrarian days, particularly when a high school diploma was, you know, really the terminal degree that would allow you to enter the workforce successfully, all of our attention was focused on making sure that students obtained the education that they needed to reach that point. The new economy requires all students to pursue an education or training after high school. And I think that one of the things we really need to do is to begin to think not of a K through 12 system, but of actually a K through 16 system so that all students get the education and training they need.
I think a lot of people would look at that lower than average percentage of graduating seniors going on to college in Vermont and say, well, there's a simple explanation to that. It's just too expensive in Vermont compared to other states.
You know, I think that that's part of it. But one of the things that we kind of know at VSAC, we've been providing career and education counseling to first-generation students right in the high schools across the state. We actually serve a caseload of students in nearly every high school. Cost and price is part of it, but an even bigger part of it is the complexity of the process of identifying an education and training program and applying for it. We know that by providing that counseling, you can increase those aspiration and continuation rates by nearly 20%.
And that's something, you know, that VSAC tries to do and outline strategies to help people close those aspiration gaps. What do you recommend?
Well, there are a couple things. You know, one, as a parent of high school seniors, hard as it is for me to really believe sometimes what parents think matters. One of the biggest factors kind of affecting student aspirations is the aspirations that their parents have. We at VSAC just got authority from the state of Vermont to initiate some pilot programs, and we're going to be looking to work with parents and schools across the state to begin to develop counseling programs that will help these students move on.
So is the goal to get every Vermont kid to college?
You know, the goal is to get every Vermont student the education or training that they'll need to achieve their goals. For some students, it may be a certificate, a two-year program, or an apprenticeship. For other kids, it may be a certificate, a two-year associate's degree, or a four-year degree. I think every student has different needs.
Scott, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Steve.
Scott Giles is president and CEO of VSAC. We've been discussing a new report that looks at gaps in gender and other factors in which Vermont high school seniors go on to college. You'll find a link to that report on our website, vpr.net. That is our program for today. For the last few days, we've been digesting the outcomes of the legislative session that ended just last Saturday. And now that we've digested, tomorrow we can discuss. VPR's Bob Kinzel will host a roundtable with some of the top political reporters in the state to look at what legislation passed, what had trouble passing and perhaps didn't, and what issues we can expect to see rise in the fall election and the next legislative session. Send your questions or comments in advance to vermontedition@vpr.net and join Bob Kinzel and the other reporters for the discussion tomorrow. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sangeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Steve Zind. Thanks for listening.